Springfield's Talk 104.1. I'm Nick Reed. It's Thursday, which means it is time for Author of the Week, sponsored by ABC Books on North Glenstone. Our author, Michael Pakalik, a PhD, Harvard Philosophy, and a professor of political economy in the Bush School of Business at the Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C. The book is Be Good Bankers, The Economic Interpretation of Matthew's Gospel. And I want to start off reading here the description of the premise, I suppose. And it says, suppose that the author of the Gospel of Matthew was an ambitious tax collector who was intricately familiar with the best practices of Roman banking, accounting, and contract law. As a result, wouldn't we expect to see a unique account of Jesus' life, death, and resurrection that was suffused with business principle and economic rationality? Now, that being said, my first question for you is, what on earth, how in the world did you come up with this angle? It just, I was racking my brain trying to figure that out.
That's a really, when you put it that way, that's a really great question. I came at it from two different angles. One is when I was a graduate student, I encountered the saying, be good bankers. And I read it in St. Francis de Sales, and he said that the ancients said that Jesus used to teach this. And so I investigated, and I learned that 10 different church fathers, Ambrose, Clement of Rome, Clement of Alexandria, Jerome, they all passed on this teaching that Jesus taught. It's not in the New Testament, be good bankers. So I started reflecting, it's so different from what we think of Jesus. So is there kind of a kind of neglected dimension of his teaching that comes from this? This is actually called an agraphon. It's a teaching of Jesus that wasn't written down in the New Testament. You kind of get a grasp of what this is if you think of it's more blessed to give than to receive. That's actually not in any of the four Gospels. It's in the book of Acts. St. Paul cites it as something that Jesus taught. And if he didn't cite it in that speech and Luke hadn't written it down, it is more blessed to give than to receive would have been an agraphon. It would have been something that was just passed on the tradition. So there are statements like that, and Be Good Bankers is one of them. So just kind of being fascinated by that and thinking about what that could mean for really a couple of decades. And then the other approach is I've written a couple of other books on the Gospels, one on Mark, and I kind of discovered St. Peter is the kind of the person behind the Gospel of Mark. And I looked at the Gospel of John on the premise that he lived together with Mary, the mother of God, for 30 years. Is there any sign that made a difference in how? I was looking at the Gospel of Matthew and thinking, well, can I carry this on? Can I say, well, who would be a person behind this gospel, influencing the gospel? And I thought, well, the idea that Jesus called Matthew away from being a tax collector is not entirely correct. Maybe he called him because he was a tax collector, just like he called fishermen so they could become fishers of men. Maybe he wanted somebody who had experience in writing things down. You know, the TV series The Chosen takes this approach. I think it's basically correct. My picture of Matthew is a little bit different, but I think that's right. He picked him because he was a tax collector.
Well, I find that your curiosity absolutely fascinating. It's something I never thought of, and I don't know that I ever would have thought of it. So I really like it because it's something new and different in terms of an approach. And I think a lot of people that are business owners, and I know we have a lot of business owners, local business owners, people in finance, and this, that are Christians, and there is this sort of, like you said, a few little cliches that I think maybe they take as cues in terms of learning about Christ and how to be a good Christian. There's tithing, but outside of that, I don't know that people have ever really thought about there being much direction. Given your dive into this, what did you learn?
Well, I want to say something about the most interesting thing about Matthew, which I learned from this in a second. But I want to first turn to what you said. And a lot of bankers and people in finance and accountants have come up to me after they've learned about my book or heard a book talk. And they said, wow, thank you so much for writing this, because typically we're under a kind of cloud of suspicion that we're just greedy people, and anyone who's involved in finance or banking has to be greedy because they're somehow they're trying to maximize their profit. And so there's a kind of a basic principle of this book, which is that God is providentially in charge of things, and he would not have designed our lives such that we need to spend 8 or 10 hours a day doing business unless he thought that was good for us and he wanted to teach us something through business. So I completely put aside this view that it's greedy to be trying to make a living and support a family and acquire substance. I reject that completely. I don't think that's a Christian idea, actually. So the book serves as a kind of invitation for people who are engaged in these kinds of occupations to go back and forth freely between those occupations and their Christian and their discipleship to Jesus and kind of have each illumine the other. That's, and if you want to say what's the basic takeaway from the book, that's certainly one of the basic takeaways. But I wanted to ask the other question, like what did I, one of the most fascinating things I think I learned about the book is the structure of the book of Matthew. Now, I don't know if you go into, you know, Gospels on your show or book, your book talk or whatever, but kind of the standard way that people look at the Gospel of Matthew is that it's a kind of layer cake, an interleaving of miracles and works of Jesus with discourses of Jesus. And five, people standardly say it's five discourses. You could kind of think of it as like structured like a layer cake. I think it's very different from that. I discovered in doing the research for this book that every household in the Roman Empire of substance had to keep a record of its accounts. And on one half of a page, they would have the revenue and receipts for the household, and on the other half of the page, the expenses. And this was used for tax purposes, so an ambitious tax collector absolutely would know about this, and was also used to solve disputes in courts of law and so on. So if you think of the kingdom of God as like a household of God, the church is like the household of God, then it ought to have a book of accounts. And the Gospel of Matthew, if you there's a place where Peter says you are the Christ, and that's in chapter 16, that you are the Christ is exactly the halfway point in the Gospel, and if you measure verses or Greek words. And Matthew says that after that point, Jesus began to teach them. He had to go up to Jerusalem to get handed over and to suffer and to be put to death. So the second half, I mean, literally the second half of the Gospel of Matthew is where one turns to the Passion. The first half of the Gospel of Matthew, of course, begins with the nativity account, with the incarnation. So if I were to say to you, Nick, let's take these two things that are put forward by the Christian faith, the incarnation on the one hand and the Passion on the other, which of those strikes you as being like a payment on the expense side of a ledger, and which of those strikes you as being like a revenue or receipt on that side of the ledger?
Go ahead.
Well, wouldn't the redemption, the Passion, which actually means redemption, actually means a purchase,
right?
Wouldn't that go on the expense side?
It seems to be.
And the incarnation is like a deposit. Well, so if you accept that basic analogy, and I explain why we should accept that analogy in the book, then the book of Matthew is actually structured like a book of accounts.
Yeah. Interesting.
And it's very interesting. You can go on from there looking at the structure in more detail. But it kind of completely turns on its head the standard kind of layer cake view about the structure of the book. That and other details, pretty strong. I think by the end, the evidence accumulates, and it's pretty overwhelming that this idea is actually true, which I propose.
We are talking with our author of the week, Michael Pakalik. The book is Be Good Bankers, The Economic Interpretation of Matthew's Gospel. What I don't want as people are listening now is to sort of pigeonhole where people think, oh, that book's not for me. Just in the brief conversation we've had thus far, this goes beyond people that are in finance. But when it does come to the finance aspect of things, again, and you mentioned people in finance and banking that come up and say thank you, how much of this also translates to people's personal finances? Because I think a lot of folks, and there's criticism oftentimes you see of people oftentimes by non-Christians of Christians that are wealthy. They portray them as being somewhat hypocritical because they are amassing worldly wealth. How much of what is learned in Matthew's gospel is gives direction in terms of personal finance?
I just want to say something about this wealthy criticism. My wife and I are certainly, you know, a lot better off than we were when we started in life, and we were, you know, pretty darn, you know, poor and kind of scraping by. And I was, you know, just the other day, we had a woman who was helps clean the house. We had people who were working on a bathroom remodeling, and we had a third person come in and fix our piano. And we actually have resources now. We can hire people like that. We never did. Wealth has to be viewed as a small kingdom. Right? So now, you know, we can kind of hire people, and they're all supporting themselves. Mm-hmm. They're supporting families. If we're having a piano fixed, are we doing something, you know, that's especially luxurious and kind of, we have a nice piano, true, but it's wealth is, except in extreme cases of people who are, you know, just absurd, but wealth is typically used to hire other people. Very good thing.
Well, and my belief is that if there are two options, one is to hand someone money for doing nothing when they are capable of earning it versus someone who earns it. It's just, I think for the individual person, it's much more meaningful for them to earn it.
Absolutely. Yeah, that was the point I made before, that God has designed us that it's actually good to be providing a greater service to another person for pay. That's a very good thing for us. But then you mentioned personal finance, and yeah, there's a section in the book which is entitled "We're all bankers now." If you think of what a banker is supposed to do, supposed to take care of deposits, manage risk, make good trades, lend money. I think that's an important role of a Christian, a very good way of doing a good deed for somebody is to lend them money at no interest. Because they, we could all just look at it from the other side. How many times have you wished that somebody would lend you money at no interest? It was close to you, right?
Well, it's like loaning them a tool.
Yeah, it really is. And as you say, it's not something for nothing. I mean, they have to return it, they have to repay it. That's the understanding. So, and that's good for them. It typically handouts are degrading and they corrupt people. So, it's a very good thing to do. Christians should think about it more often, especially older generation as regards to newer generation. If people try and buy a house for the first time, you know, instead of, it's a sacrifice if you take that money out of a retirement account and you give it to a young couple and say, okay, repay this at no interest. Okay, you're foregoing the money you could have made in your investments. That's true. But that's the form of your gift. It is a gift to God. But yes, it's true. Everybody in their own little domain has to operate a bit like a banker. And that means being responsible. And it means that there's no free lunch. You have to know the value of things. And you have to know that anything you get comes at the cost of what you could have otherwise spent that money on. That's called opportunity cost by economists. And this is very valuable to think of life in this way.
Well, the final question I have, and again, I ask this because this is such a unique approach, and so I think a lot of people listening, they're like, I don't know that I really get this, and so I don't want people to be intimidated away from reading it, thinking, I don't know that this applies to me. So what is it that you hope people take away, and who would you say that this book is for?
Well, this book is... It's for people who are interested in Christianity and, you know, potentially put off by what they view as its softness and sentimentality and lack of practical realism, because I think that Christianity is supposed to be practically real. And it's also for people who are, you know, very familiar with the book of Matthew and think they don't need to read it again because they've heard it so many times. And I think, as you've been saying, there's something really very fresh here and new. I have to say that. It'd be dishonest if I didn't claim that it was new. It is a new thing, and I think it's also true. So something that's both new and true is pretty unusual in the world.
Agreed.
So I think I can say that about this book.
Well, absolutely 100% agree. Again, our author of the week, sponsored by ABC Books on North Glenstone, Michael Pakalik. The book is Be Good Bankers, The Economic Interpretation of Matthew's Gospel. For Springfield's Talk 104.1, I'm Nick Reed.